You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters Live. Welcome to the podcast that showcases the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food and drinks industries. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food and drink. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, a TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Now, I love the sensory experience of food and drink, obviously, but I particularly love the stories that lie behind them, because stories inform those sensory experiences with history, with science, wisdom, craft, and especially the stories of the people involved. And in this episode, we're looking at one of the truly great stories, the history and future of whiskey. It's a bumpy ride through illicit trade, refined techniques, boom and bust, and dodgy dealings. At the moment, whiskey production is surging into new territory. Distilleries are popping up in Tasmania, Japan, India, and even in the Arctic Circle. So let's take a look. And to guide us, I'm delighted to welcome to the podcast a whiskey consultant and broker, contributing editor to Cask and Still magazine, the founder of World Whiskey Day, and a man who holds a world record, having visited 60 whiskey distilleries in just one day. It's the wonderful Blair Bowman. Blair, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Stefan.
Brilliant to have you here. Now, first of all, you've got to tell me about the 60 distilleries in a day. What's all that about?
It was a lot of fun. It was to raise money for charity. We thought it was a bit bonkers. We thought, how many distilleries can we squeeze into by visiting in one day? And we collected a very special, unique bottle at each distillery. All these bottles were gathered up. And rather than kind of release them individually as prizes, one person, by entering a raffle, would win all 60 plus bottles.
Oh, wow.
And I think the guy that won only bought like £10 worth of raffle tickets. But, you know, we raised, I think, well over £10,000 for a water charity that I've worked with.
Yeah.
And it was all a bit of a whirlwind, but it was pretty amazing. And I doubt anyone would be mad enough to try and beat that.
Yeah, I'd love to stick with that. Yeah, you don't need to try that again either yourself, do you? Come on.
No.
Okay, right. So this is, we're really fascinated in the history of whiskey here. Now, people have been distilling alcohol for thousands of years. It's one of those fundamental things that humans do, you know, the gifts of civilization, you know, settle down and distill. So when do we first get something that is recognisable as whiskey, and what defines that?
So, as you say, it's been around for thousands of years, and every kind of civilization would distill what they had locally in abundance. So, you know, the reason we started distilling barley was we had barley surpluses that wouldn't maybe last over the winter, and distilling it gave you another commodity that you could trade with and barter with, and so on. So kind of that was how it started. The earliest written reference that we have is from 1494 in Lindores Abbey in Fife, of a friar John Corr ordering malt with which to make ushkava or aquavite, which is what we would understand to be whiskey today. So that was the first time someone had bothered to write about it that we still got records of. But, you know, probably we're making it much longer than that. But essentially, it's unchanged really since then. We're still using the same ingredients by law. We must use water, malted barley and yeast. And that's it. So it's three ingredients, very simple. Mm. And this was the thing that really fascinated me and got the bug about Scotch whiskey in particular, was when I realised all these whiskies that I'd tasted were all made using the same three ingredients, the same process. You know, you basically turn it to a mash, you know, you ferment it and then you distill it. So the processes are all the same at each distillery you visit, but they all taste so wildly different. And the spectrum of flavours is, I would argue, bigger than any other drink. You know, other drinks category people might say, oh, you know, rums or wines or whatever, but actually whiskey really is such a broad spectrum, from the fruitiest, most tropical, delicate whiskies to something that you think should taste like eating a tire,
yeah,
or like medicine, or like just, you know, almost shouldn't be a drink. And that was, you know, for me, it was Laphroaig that I discovered as a young 18-year-old. And I drank that and thought, wow, I've never experienced these flavors before. And, you know, it was that kind of Marmite moment of like, I love this, but should I like this? This is weird, you know, and it burns and it tastes like TCP and, you know, fishing boats and rusted paint and like all these, but actually this is lovely. So yeah, that was when, you know, I really first got into it. It was really just as a young 18-year-old and got the bug, as I said, and kind of scratched under the surface and just, I've not looked back. And as you know, I'm 32 now, and so I'm still relatively young within the whiskey industry, but whiskey's been my life, you know, full time essentially since then.
Yeah. So we naturally associate whiskey with Scotland and Ireland. And the big question, I'd say Scotland, and it's just world famous for whiskey, isn't it? I mean, it's the export industry is huge.
Yeah.
Question is why? Why did it take off in those parts of the world? Are we talking climate, expertise, love of ethanol?
I mean, I think there's a lot of factors, and we probably don't have time to go into them all, but a lot of it is probably serendipity and timing and, you know, right place, right time. You know, there was the phylloxera bug that kind of destroyed the grape vines in France in the 1880s, just at the time when blended Scotch had first appeared on the market. So that's a combination of single grain whiskey that was made in more industrial kind of bulk way, combined with the more flavorful single malts. You know, that was, you know, great timing for the blended Scotch brands, because suddenly there was no cognac and the kind of the upper classes wanted something similar. It was much more palatable. This new blended Scotch whiskey was much more, you know, consistent. It was less volatile, it was less fiery. It wasn't going to burn your face off.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was good timing. You know, the Scots have always been very entrepreneurial. I think that's a big part of it. The marketing, there was a lot of marketing gimmicks, fantastic marketing gimmicks, you know, from these entrepreneurs that would be the kind of Elon Musks of, you know, their day, you know, throwing ridiculous sums of money at, you know, random marketing projects. And, you know, Tommy Dewar is a great example, that supposedly he would pay for horse guards in London to change the tread to say, like, drink Dewar's whiskey. And that would be kind of all over the mud tracks around London. And
brilliant.
You know, really clever, little, funny, gimmicky things like that. And, you know, other brands, I think it was Dewar's as well, actually, that took out huge advertising during Prohibition in the US, you know, during Prohibition. So everywhere you were getting bombarded with adverts about Dewar's, but you couldn't get it. So as soon as, you know, it was dropped, bang, everybody shoots to grab Dewar's. And it's still, I think, the number one brand for blends in the US.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it was a lot of things like that that all kind of contributed to, you know, Scotch whiskey being this success story. But a really interesting nugget of history is, you know, it's been exported a hell of a long time. And supposedly before the first bottle of Coca-Cola made its way to Europe, Johnnie Walker was already available in 100 markets, which is pretty impressive.
That is extraordinary, isn't it? Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and early, you know, in the 1900s, Johnnie Walker had, you know, offices in Sydney and, you know, all around the place. So I think we've had this long run in, and that's how we've kind of cemented this position of Scottish whiskey being at the top of the kind of whiskey pyramid.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned that it's sort of simple, certainly in terms of the ingredients, but obviously the skill involved in brewing the stuff, distilling it, is deep and complex and presumably full of lots of secrets and wonder. I mean, did it land in a Scotland that was ready for the engineering tools that were really needed for it as well? I mean, is it part of an industrial revolution that allowed these big distilleries and all the kit that was needed for it to be built?
Yeah, there was definitely an element of that. You know, there was these constant innovations. You know, the introduction of the continuous still was the big one. That meant that they could scale up, you know, because before that, there was this kind of battle between the legal distilleries and the illicit distilleries. The illicit ones were actually making what was seen to be a much high quality product, much better than the licensed ones. The licensed ones were kind of churning out as fast as they could, trying to use, you know, as minimal, you know, barley, keeping costs down. But actually, the illicit guys had a much bigger audience because they were making much high quality whiskey. So I think it was a part of that. But then, you know, there was this kind of level of investment of these distilleries were churning out, you know, hundreds of thousands of litres by a certain point. And it was just opening up these markets to send it around the world. Yeah. Again, it was all around this kind of time. The first trains were introduced. So that meant that all the, you know, trains going up to Speyside could bring up the raw materials. So bringing the casks in and barley and whatever, but then also bringing the casks back down to the central belt of kind of Glasgow and Edinburgh and Perth for blending and bottling. So, you know, all of these elements of the Industrial Revolution kind of contributed to its success.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I mean, you talked a little bit about this, sort of the moonshining sort of side of it. Now, I mean, how much of the history of whiskey is about money? Because obviously it's one of the things that has been taxed enormously. And taxes...
Still is.
Taxes cause great resentment as well. And also, the moment you tax something and make it more expensive, you start getting people making it on the sly and moonshining. So are there some interesting stories there about the moonshining industry and taxation avoidance?
Absolutely. I mean, it kind of ran in parallel. So the first kind of duties were introduced in 1644. And basically since that point onwards, there has been this constant up until kind of 1820s when things were really a bit more grounded. There was this kind of 200-year period of chasing the illicit distillers around the highlands and islands. And, you know, the nature of Scotland's geography meant it was pretty easy that you could hide a tiny little still in a little glen, have it on the back of a cart that a horse could pull, and word of mouth would spread very quickly if an excise man was in town, and you know, you could smuggle it away and hide it. So there has been this kind of constant cat and mouse story really around that time, and especially around the kind of Glenlivet Speyside area. You know, supposedly there was up to 400 stills in the 1800s, illicit stills that were constantly being chased by these excise men. And then in that period between kind of 1644 up until the kind of 1823 Excise Act, there were kind of 30 plus different iterations of tax and duty. And they were constantly trying to find a solution that worked, and they just never really worked. But that was the one that then meant that it was a little bit more balanced, because, you know, a lot of the landowners actually just kind of let it happen, because it meant that their kind of tenant farmers had the cash to actually pay their rent.
There's a lot to be said for it. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so it was brushed to the side and people didn't really talk about it, and they just kind of let it happen. I mean, even in 1822, when King George IV visited Edinburgh on this very pomp and ceremony visit to Scotland, he specifically asked for whiskey from Glenlivet, which at the time was illicit. And according to the records of that time, that was all he drank during his visit. You know, so all of that added to the kudos and the cachet of this illicit whiskey.
Yeah. Did it also feature as a sort of independence and rebellion story? Is it a story of English versus Scottish? And
there probably is a part of that. Yeah, there is. You know, there was a lot of cross-border trade, and a lot of that became challenging again during these different iterations, where it became too onerous or too taxed really to trade over the border. There was also differences when there was the establishment of the Highland and Lowland line. The Lowlands were essentially licensed and the Highlands were unlicensed. And, you know, there was challenges there where the Highland producers weren't allowed to even export below that line because it would be competing with the kind of licensed distillers. So there was a lot of that. And, you know, there probably was a bit of that kind of Scottish-English rebellion, I'd imagine.
And then moving into the 19th century, we have the first licensing act in the 1820s, I think you said.
Yeah, 1823, yeah.
And by the late 1800s, whiskey, it's a booming industry. But then there's a big crash. And tell us, it's a story about the Paterson brothers, I believe. And tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, the Paterson brothers were quite flamboyant characters, to say the least, and were on the outside running a very successful growing business, but were actually running up enormous debt. So because the industry had become so successful commercially for so many players, banks were giving out, you know, very healthy loans and very healthy credit lines. And these brothers were inflating the numbers a bit in terms of the properties that they owned, the values on the books didn't really match up.
Yeah.
And, you know, they would quite famously purposefully miss trains in Peebles, which is in the Borders, to basically then have to charter a private train at great expense with press kind of waiting for them at Edinburgh Waverley. You know, it was all this kind of stuff. And the thing they were most famous for was actually training 500 African parrots to say, drink Paterson's whiskey. And distributing these across pubs in Scotland and England. So, I mean, it's weird to think about it now, walking into a pub and there being a live parrot advert. But that was what these guys did. But yeah, essentially, I think it was 1898 when it was kind of unraveled and they filed for liquidation, and there was about $500,000 deficit on the books.
Which is big money in the 1800s.
Oh. And that then pulled down 10 other businesses directly associated, had to file for bankruptcy. And then it all just kind of fell down from there. So, you know, I don't think it was just them. There was a lot of people in this space where the industry was seen to be booming. So there was a lot of, you know, speculation and loans and credit and all of that kind of added on to it. And I think they were just the catalyst that just kind of made it all fall down.
Now, I'm heading off to Islay in about 3 weeks' time on a little whiskey tour with a couple of mates of mine.
Fantastic.
But I don't really know very much about whiskey. I really it's one of those strange things where I know that the flavours and the stories around them are so rich, and yet I've almost been scared to get properly involved in it. Now, you very kindly sent me some samples of some whiskies, and I wondered, could you guide me through tasting them and what I should be looking for in the experience and what makes it wonderful, really?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm delighted to share these. I've got the same samples here ready to go.
Excellent.
Do you want to do a little taste test experiment first?
Let's do it.
So in the kit that I sent you, I've sent you a little jelly bean. So you'll need to have both of your hands available for this, I'm afraid.
Yep.
So with one hand, I want you to pinch your nose really tight. Okay, we'll do it together. We'll both look silly, but it's on video, so it's fine.
Okay.
Now, put the jelly bean in your mouth.
Yeah.
And give it a good crunch, a good chew.
Mm-hmm.
And now let go.
It just floods up your nose. The old retronasal olfaction just explodes up there.
Exactly. You know it. Retronasal olfaction is exactly what's happened there. So it's something people really don't understand is how much we can smell. You know, our sense of smell is so important. And I've been, you know, actually following the whole COVID thing very closely because that's one of the key symptoms. And unfortunately, a lot of people with long COVID have lost their sense of smell, which is really emotionally quite of a challenge because we rely so much on our sense of smell to protect us from food that is off and, you know, food that is nice. So it's just one of these things we take so much pleasure in, but so many people take it for granted. So just a little bit of fun there to show you that, you know, we can smell a lot more than we can taste.
And there are only five tastes, aren't there? Well, there's a bit of argument over every couple more, possibly, but...
Well, yes, but essentially bittersweet, sour, savoury and umami are the kind of recognised tastes. But when you combine that with your sense of smell, you can paint these beautifully rich, amazing aromas and flavours. You can start to understand them, but without using the nose, you're just going to get those basic tastes. So,
yeah, it would just be sweet, the jelly baby that I've just had.
The crunch of the jelly bean. Yeah, exactly. You got the textural element, but that's really about it, and the sweetness. So my point there is, you know, when we're going through these whiskies together, let's really smell them for a while, because there's a difference between nosing and tasting a whiskey and drinking a whiskey. Drinking a whiskey is, you know, having a cocktail, having a highball, having a however you want. But when you're kind of drinking whiskey to analyze it, which I do for a lot of my work with clients, is kind of sensory analysis of casks, you know, a lot of it is done on the nose. Yeah. And the other nice thing to remember is there's no wrong answers ever. Your sense of smell and experience is completely unique to you, where you've visited, what you've, you know, experienced in your life. And the more you explore food and drink and whatever, you can, again, add to your glossary of vocabulary. So whenever I was kind of traveling pre-COVID in, you know, interesting far-flung places, one of the first things I'd try and do is go to a local market and get to try, you know, weird and wonderful fruits and vegetables that we just, you know, don't get in the UK very easily. So things like mangosteen, or, you know, and again, having that vocabulary when I'm then with clients in these places, being able to articulate, you know, this is what I get from this whiskey, you know, and having that kind of cultural understanding.
Yeah. Yeah, a big part of tasting is being able to, is the expressing, isn't it? Is giving yourself the argot, that pool of words within which to grab things. And if you don't have that, I get that a lot when I get people to taste things during live shows, and people come up on stage and they'll try something. They're rabbit in the headlights anyway, but often they just haven't got the tools at their disposal. They have all of the experiences that we all have, but they just haven't got the tools at their disposal to put to the experience.
And it comes with practice, though. You know, it's like anything, comes with practice. And that was the reason I've actually sent you three whiskies to taste.
Yeah.
Is even if people can't articulate in very detailed words, they can at least compare and contrast differences. So they can say, actually, I can't say why this one is my preferred one, but I know that there's a difference. So almost a kind of ABC kind of test, essentially. But in the way that I think about it, which is a bit strange, it's almost like a game of guess who when I'm writing tasting notes. I can start very big and think, am I getting, you know, citrus, for example? And then I'm going to zoom in a level and then think, right, is it grapefruit or is it lemon or is it lime or is it blood orange or what is it? And then kind of zoom in again and then think, right, okay, it's a pink grapefruit, but it's the rind of the pink grapefruit. So,
oh, yeah, very good.
This kind of like honing in is kind of what I'm doing when I'm tasting and analysing whiskies. And that's the way to kind of start to think about it. But as I say, there's no wrong answers ever. So if you're only getting whiskey, you're still getting something. You know, your nose is working. Your sensory system is working. Maybe with a bit of practice and with a bit of comparison tasting A and B, you'll start to then pick out, oh, actually, this one's a bit more spicy or this one's a bit more nutty or whatever.
Yeah. And just before we start, I mean, do you think that you should always taste whiskies together so that you get a sense of context, so that you can compare and contrast? Because if you just have the one whiskey, you don't have a frame of reference.
I think it's a really good way to drink, if that makes sense. I think drinking two things or consuming two things of anything, you know, buying two different types of shampoo and seeing which one you prefer or anything, you know, having something as a point of contrast is important, because when you're just consuming or enjoying something in isolation, it's hard to have that full understanding of what makes it different.
Okay, how should we go about this then?
So let's start with the blend, which is the famous grouse.
Okay, and just neat?
Yeah, just neat. Let's pour it in and have a little taste and, you know, stick your nose in. And the thing I would say is we can actually tell a lot about whiskey before we even put our nose in it. We can tell a lot by the colour. So typically in Scotland, we're using casks that are ex-bourbon or ex-sherry. We don't often use virgin oak. It's become more popular now, but for a long time, it just wasn't used. And we're quite kind of stingy.
And that colour will become apparent.
Yeah, the colour will become apparent. So if it's a kind of lighter straw-like colour, it's probably been in a bourbon cask. If it's a much more amber, kind of darker colour, it's probably been in a sherry cask. By law, we can use colour We can actually adjust the color with a thing called E150A. A lot of brands do, but a lot of them don't and say specifically we're using natural color. But anyway, we can tell that. Another thing we can tell is the strength by kind of swirling around the glass and then leaving it to stop. You can see these kind of teardrops and kind of legs appearing like when drinking wine. And if it's got much more kind of heavier, thicker, slower teardrops, we can tell it's got a higher strength.
Yeah.
Just, and this is before we've even kind of put it in your mouth or our nose. So
there's an extraordinary beauty to it, isn't it? Just that color.
Well, I mean, the whole process, you know, we've got little sample bottles today, but you know, I think there's something quite special about the whole opening of it, a bit like a champagne bottle, you know, taking the foil off, the kind of, you know, the first kind of glug, 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 like all of that for me is part of the journey. This whiskey's been on this. The whiskey is a minimum of 3 years old by law, but actually, you know, most whiskey is much older than that. And if you're on, you know, the other side of the world and you're drinking a whiskey that's maybe 15, 30, 45, 50 plus years old, you know, it's been on this incredible journey of just patience. You've been getting on with your life. It's come to you. You've opened it. You've put it in a glass. And now all of its job is ready to be performed in the space of unlocking it, you know, and as soon as you consume that, it's kind of
unlocking it.
That's it, you know, it's this beautiful, short, magic moment of time that's led up to that point. Anyway, I get quite excited, dramatic about it.
So you're right, you are, I know, but I like that. That's fantastic. I mean, but what you're saying is we're drinking its history as well, and that's fascinating too. Yeah. Okay. I mean, obviously, the first thing that comes to mind is just is the heat of the ethanol for me. And then,
And if for a lot of people who are not used to drinking spirits, you know, it's quite a jump. If most people are drinking, you know, beers and wines, to then suddenly have a neat spirit of minimum, again, by law, 40%, that's a big jump. So highballs and other cocktails and stuff are a great way to do that. But just have a little sip just to kind of let your palate know we're drinking alcohol. So cheers. Slangeva.
Cheers. Oh, it's the heat, isn't it? It's that warmth that just fires you to start with.
And if that's something that you get a lot of when you're drinking whiskey, the way around that is to add water.
Yeah.
Just a little droplet of water to the point where you're not getting the burn.
Yeah.
You're just getting, it just opens up. That's what adding water does. The opposite thing happens if you put ice in a whiskey or chill it down, it contracts. So you get more singular flavors coming out of it. And I actually really love doing that. I really love putting bottles in the freezer.
Yeah.
Single grain whiskey in particular, frozen, because it won't freeze because of the high alcohol, but it just comes out so syrupy. And as you drink it, it adjusts up to room temperature. So it starts to unlock. It's really a fascinating way.
And adds to that journey all over again.
Yeah.
So it takes you up and down the mountains, basically.
So have a second sip. So our sensory system knows we're drinking alcohol now. Mm-hmm. You know, there's that fight or flight mode of, oh my goodness, this is alcohol. What are we doing? It's kind of lunchtime on a Friday.
Yeah.
So it's just that the first sip, I would, a bit like the first pancake you make. Don't really think about the first pancake. You know, the first sip, don't really think about it too much. Just let your body know this is what we're doing. Then have a second sip, and then start to think more about the flavors that you get.
And then it's just a complexity that I wish I could explain a little bit more. But certainly, things, you know, those toffee elements and sort of
absolutely
biscuits and a lot, but really complex sets of flavors that are bound together.
I mean, another way that some people enjoy kind of tasting or experiencing is actually putting a tiny little drop into your palm. And then rubbing your palm together very, very rapidly.
Ah.
It then will create the evaporation.
Kind of using it like a perfume.
Yeah, exactly. To kind of vaporize it almost.
Right, I'm going to do that as well then.
And then you'll get different, more of the top notes kind of come out. You'll get more maltiness.
Oh, yeah.
Especially from this. So this is, I should explain, a blended scotch. So it's, you know, the backbone of the whiskey industry. 90% of what we export is still blend. So, you know, this is Famous Grouse, for example, but Bell's, Johnny Walker, Chivas, you know, Dewar's, all these famous names.
Yeah, and all immensely popular.
Oh, incredible brands, incredible histories, and fantastic products. To make this product consistently, year in, year out, is, you know, mind-blowing.
Yeah.
You know, it's a real skill to be a master blender that does this.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of snobbery, though, unfortunately, around blends because they're perceived to be cheaper, because generally they are cheaper to make, so they're sold at a cheaper price point. But actually, it's just as much skill to blend consistently from different inventory, different stocks.
Yes.
So within the blend, you know, you'll have about, well, it depends on the blend, but at least 50% will be the grain whiskey because it is more industrial, it's, you know, made in bigger volumes, it's cheaper. Mm. And then it'll be topped up with more flavorful single malt. But it could be as high as a ratio of kind of 80-20, you know, 90-10, you know, it really depends on the brand. But the more flavorful single malts can then create this balance of flavors with a little bit of smoke from maybe Isla or sweetness from Speyside or whatever the blender is using. So that's kind of how these blends are made. And they should really be championed because they're fantastic products. Just because it's cheaper doesn't mean it's worse at all.
Hello there, only me. I just want to break into this conversation to say that if you're enjoying this episode, then once it's finished, you might want to check out the rest of our History Of series. We've covered tea, chocolate, sugar, and loads more. You can find them all at foodmatterslive.com. And now, back to the chat. So what are those other tools at the distiller's disposal in terms of flavour? So you talked about smokiness and sweetness, but when there's only those three ingredients, how do you add these different elements?
There's so many variables. This is the fascinating thing. So the barley variety that you're using, and there's a lot of fascinating research going into heritage varieties and bringing back different styles of barley that we've not seen for a long time that have different flavour characteristics. Terroir is becoming a big conversation in whiskey and hadn't really been discussed at all until a few years ago. So there's kind of that element. There's then how do you malt it? So are you going to kind of almost over toast it like a chocolate malt? Or are you going to dry it with smoke, with peat? How long are you going to peat it for? That's another element. You've then got, everyone kind of grinds it roughly the same way out. A mill is a mill, essentially. But then you're making your mash. So, what temperatures are you putting the water in the mash?
And just to be clear for our listeners, what is a mash?
Oh, sorry, the mash is like making meat porridge. So we've ground the barley and then we're going to put in different sets of waters to try and extract, almost like a tea bag, that you're trying to extract as much sugar as possible from this in the most efficient manner as possible, because we need the sugar to ferment, to convert into alcohol. So that's the mash. And again, it depends how fast you're running it. There's these kind of subtle variables. And then the next phase is the fermentation. And again, there's now really exciting research going into yeasts. And for a long time, people were just using pretty industry standard distiller's yeast. But now people are doing really cool stuff with beer yeasts, champagne yeasts, wild yeasts, fermenting for really, really long periods of time. All of these variables will change the final result. A lot of people think distilling is, going to strip all that out. But actually, all of these little parts will pass through in a certain way. So then you will have what's called a wash. So then we're going to distill it. So again, there's variables, the shape of the still, the height of the still, how fast you're running it, where the cut points are. These are all variables again. And then there is this kind of wider discussion around the importance of wood. It's going to sit in there for at least 3 years. It must be oak by law in Scotland. There is a kind of feeling within a lot of the industry that kind of 70 to 80 plus percent of the final taste in the glass is from the oak, or is from the cask. So it is a big part, it's a really important part, and there's much more understanding. I actually wrote my dissertation on the history of sherry casks traded between Spain and Scotland, because, I think it's a fascinating thing. That essentially barrels have remained unchanged. Coopering is unchanged, and it's just one of these amazing things that back in the day, barrels were the kind of cardboard box of today. What we now have, everywhere, these IKEA boxes and, Amazon boxes, everything was shipped around the world in barrels, so fish and nails and cheese and butter and whatever. And, casks were used in that way for storing this surplus grain that had been distilled. It was only by accident that they realized that putting it in a, sherry cask, because sherry had been brought into the UK, or bourbon or whatever had been brought in, actually benefited this pretty fiery, punchy spirit. Sorry, it's a little bit of a tangent there about casks. I got a bit excited.
but that's exactly what you. I mean, that's why it's such a wonderful drink, because there's history that, as you say, you're drinking history. So the grouse that we're tasting, I would say, I don't get much smoke from that. There's sort of biscuity, malty, maybe.
There's a tiny bit, just a little malty, woody, spicy, nutty, almost a kind of like a Kellogg crunchy nut. Kind of cornflake kind of thing.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
That's what I get from this. And again, a lot of people might turn their nose up at a blend like Famous Grouse, but actually I think it's fantastic. I think blends are, I've said already, I do think blends are really underrated. And a lot of people, it's funny, on their kind of whiskey journey then become very snobby to blends, but at one stage they would have all started with blends. They would have been at this very early stage in their journey and not known the difference between a single malt and a blend. and had them and enjoyed them. And then for whatever reason, they become a little bit snobby and think, oh, no, you know, it's too cheap for me. I'm only going to drink, you know, 30-year-old scotch from now on or whatever, which annoys me. So absolutely, I'm here for the blends.
OK, so what's next? We've got two more. We've got Highland Park 12.
Yes. So let's go to Highland Park next. So let's pour a little bit of that. So this time, what I'm going to get you to do is have another smell first, but then we're going to do something just for, again, a little bit of fun. So you'll see this has got a little bit of a richer, darker colour. Yeah. So it's had some sherry casks. So Highland Park is from the island of Orkney, right in the north of Scotland. They're pretty unusual in the fact that they're still doing hand malting. So they're turning the barley by hand. There's only about five or six distilleries that are still using that. Again, very traditional process.
Yeah.
You know, up until the kind of 60s and 70s, everybody had to have their own floor maltings. But you have a smell of that. So do you get a little bit of a kind of peat smoke there?
Yep, a little bit smoky, kind of woody.
So it's got an interesting thing because the peat that they're using is actually from Orkney, you know, so peat is millions of years old and it's based on what was above it, you know, millennia ago. And on Orkney, there's not many trees. So it doesn't have that same kind of level of vegetation and kind of salty seaweediness that you get from Isla peat or different parts of the mainland have different kind of peats. So it's interesting how, again, there's another variable for you, the peat that you're using will create a different sense of smoke.
Yeah, it's there's a very different sensation there. I mean, there's a heft to it. There's a toasted sort of a depth, I think, that I didn't get at all from the famous grouse.
Yeah, there's a nice kind of bacony, like maple syrup.
Yeah,
like maple syrup and bacon, kind of on a barbecue on a beach. So you have one small sip first, and then what I'm going to get you to do is, I'm going to get you to take another larger sip and I'm going to count down from 12. And as I'm counting down, I want you to swirl it around your mouth and coat all your taste buds and all your gums. Okay, so ready when you are and I'll start counting.
Okay, sipping.
Okay, go. So 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Wow.
Swallow. There you go. So that might seem a bit weird.
But it's lovely. That's the trouble. The burn is so gorgeous. It's a dangerous tool.
But I wanted to do that to you to show that, you know, so this is a Highland Park 12-year-old. So it spent 12 years patiently waiting, you know, to be enjoyed.
Exactly. Yeah. And then so much comes out as well. And you start this sort of flowery.
Yeah.
Kind of fruitiness to it as well.
It's quite floral, yeah.
The depth is just extraordinary. I mean, you know, we think about the most complex flavours being things like coffee and chocolate, but that has so much going on. It's
yeah, and you could spend hours getting to know it, you know, and letting it open up, and you know, it will oxidise slightly in the glass and start to release more. Or as I've said, if you add a little splash of water, that will open it up, and you'll see kind of oils appear on the surface, and it's essentially just more whiskey.
Yeah, and it says Viking Honour. So is there some non Scottish aspect to it, or is the Vikings in Orkney?
The Vikings were pretty prominent in Orkney back in the day, and Highland Park have kind of leaned into that brand. They've got a big audience in Scandinavia, so you know, Scandinavians also love the Vikings and that mythology.
Yeah, is it a big deer on the normal box? Isn't it a big? Is it short of a deer? Or?
Not sure.
Oh no, that one's a.
There's a lot of lovely hand. Celtic kind of crosses and Celtic kind of twists, and they've spent a lot of time kind of repositioning that Viking theme throughout the Highland Park brand. And I should highlight that this is different from Famous Grouse in the fact that it's a single malt, and single means it's from a single place, a single distillery. And a lot of people, again, get very confused around that. But yeah, that's the element of single, is that it's from a single place. So everything apart from the malting and the maturation must be done. So those processes I just talked through, they almost need to be done at that single site in order to be called a single malt Scotch whisky.
Now, do different distilleries have... Are they competitive in the sense that they're jealous of each other, that there is a competitiveness that is kind of a bitterness between rivals, or is it very much a community?
It's a real community, and I would say there is a competitiveness at the marketing and sales end of the journey.
Yes.
But on the ground, at production level, it's open door policy, really. Yeah. You know, there's a real collaborative community of sharing knowledge. You know, knowledge exchange is a big thing, you know, globally, actually, distilleries doing exchange programs and partnerships.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially now at the moment, there's so much R&D going into how to be more renewable and sustainable.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, reusing energy, reusing heat, and actually sharing that with everybody, because it's for everybody's benefit.
Yeah.
So at that level, on the production side, it's, you know, it's not like Wizard of Oz. There's no secrets to hide. You know,
yeah,
it's kind of come and see us, we'll come and see you, we'll share knowledge.
So when I go to Islay and wander around the distilleries, they're not going to be fighting in the streets. They're
No, not at all. And, you know, a lot of them will move around and work at different places that the production guys.
Yeah.
You know, it's especially on the island of Islay, it's such a small community, an island community that, you know, whiskey is that island. You know, there's so much history connected to that place. And one little tip, when you're driving around, there's a thing called the Islay Wave, which is this very subtle kind of nod and right raise of the fingers when you drive past any vehicle. So you'll notice that when you're driving around, and you'll try and continue to do it when you get back on the mainland, but actually nobody does that here, do they? But I just think it's really nice.
I used to ride a VW camper van. There was a lot of that going on between the camper vans.
Of course, yeah.
Okay, so what else are we looking for here? So this is a single malt. I'd say it's got a vast amount of character. Not that the famous grouse didn't have character, but this seems to be so much more individual, and the flavour compounds that are there seem to be that much stronger in their sort of drive, that sort of toasty, woody.
It's just got that intensity, maybe, because it is a single malt. You know, to take it even a step beyond that, a lot of what I deal in is single casks. So a single cask, single malt whiskey is one cask from that one place. So it's, again, even more singular because it's totally unique. So even though on one day, you know, hundreds of casks will all be filled into identical types of wood, the fact that a cask is organic, they're all going to be subtly different, you know, like siblings or whatever. They're all going to be similar. There's going to be a kind of house style, but they're all going to have their own uniqueness. And, you know, that's what gets really exciting when you get to that geeky level of whiskey, that if you try a single cask whiskey that you like, and there's only ever going to be, let's say, 200 bottles from that cask, once all those are opened, it's extinct. You can't replicate it ever, no matter how hard you try. And once people kind of get that, they're like, wow, I need to buy a case of that or two cases of that because it's so good and I don't want
to keep that going for years to come.
But you can't, you know, and that's the magic of whiskey, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, what about water? My experience of lots of these industries is that people will make claims about things that don't necessarily pan out. But is the source of water an influencer on the final taste of whiskey?
Again, it depends who you ask. But I would argue that there will be. Of course there will be. Again, you know, there's lots of minerals that play. If you look at a map of Scotland, a distillery map of Scotland, a lot of them, well, all of them are all centred around significant water sources. You know, there's a reason for that. Quite famously, there's people who have tried to build distilleries recently that bought land, you know, got everything ready and actually didn't have a water source. It's absolutely fundamental. You need a hell of a lot of water to make whiskey. You need a high quality, consistent water source. And, you know, Scotland's got fascinating geology. Depending on where you are in the country, there'll be different water, you know, hard water, soft water, you know, depending on where you are. There is a myth that has perpetuated within consumers that the peatiness comes from the water, which just isn't true. That, you know, peatiness comes from the drying process of the malted barley. So that is annoying. That kind of, someone said it once and it's somehow stuck.
And for somebody like you, that's agony. It's like, no, come on.
Yeah, it's just, it's in the barley. It's in the drying process. But anyway, no, I think it does. You know, you're using a lot of water in this process to make whiskey. I think it will, how it reacts with the yeasts, you know, all of that will play a part in terms of the minerality. So I would argue that it does. Some distilleries go to the point where, you know, if they're maturing on site and bottling on site, when they're reducing it to what's called bottling strength, so, you know, that legal minimum of 40%, they will insist on using the same water source that they used for the distilling, you know. So there will be.
Yes. So when the spirit is distilled, do you get a pure ethanol? How much ethanol is in that distillate?
It depends on where you're cutting and depends on, you know, how hard you're running it and so on. But it comes off as a crystal clear vodka type spirit that, you know, looks and smells not really all that much like what we're drinking. You know, it's pretty intense. Depends on the, you know, spirit character that they're going for. Some of them are actually intentionally quite sulfury and quite, you know, rich and heavy and oily because they know it's going to be longer matured. And in that maturation, those more sulfury elements will come off, but it will leave a heavier, thicker, oilier texture. So it does depend on how the operation is kind of set up and what kind of spirit character they're going for.
But will most distillers expect to have to water down the distillate?
So yes, so normally, actually, before it goes into the cask, they will reduce it to 63.5%, which has just become this kind of industry standard amount that if you put it into that amount in your cask, you're not going to have too much water in that cask. You don't want to be storing water for 10 years. You know, you want to be storing as much alcohol as you can. But also, you don't want to put in too high. Some do put it in at higher strengths. But again, that's going to create a different reaction in the cask. It might strip more of the tannins out of the wood because of the intense alcohol. So there's, again, more variables there that you can play with as a distiller.
Now, when you're creating a new blend or you're coming up with a new product and trying out a new idea, it must be so painful because you create the stuff. You've got to wait 3 years, presumably. Or maybe you can, if you're very clever, you can get a sense of how it's going, which is it going in the right direction a little bit earlier than that. But generally speaking, you've got to wait forever for the product to come through, and then you go, nah, that's rubbish. We're going to have to ditch that one.
It's a long-term game, whiskey. Well, I mean, it does happen. I've heard of quite famous examples of people that put, you know, spirit into certain wine casks and actually didn't realise how intense the wine would influence it, and it's become overly influenced. And it's, you know, they would never pour it down the drain. They would find a way to kind of blend it off in another product. You know, it'd never be wasted. But it is one of these things you can kind of on paper, though, make kind of realistic expectations of how something should perform. And especially if you're producing on a big volume, there will be a general vatting that will stabilize inconsistencies. But yeah, you are right that to a degree, there's a lot of it will be, let's wait and see what it's like when we think this is ready for bottling.
Yeah.
But, you know, casks are being monitored and checked on a pretty regular basis when they're approaching that kind of bottling phase.
Yeah. So the follow-on question from that really is it an industry that feeds on innovation? And I know you mentioned things like ecologically conscious distilling and looking after heat. But my view of the whiskey industry is not this sort of, well, they're coming up with a new thing. It's, this is the stuff that is amazing because it's been amazing for 200 years. So is innovation slightly frowned on in the whiskey industry? I mean, you know, it's a bit like a cheesemaker, you know, making a cheese stuffed with spices or chili or something. And I look at them and go, no, that's not what I want. I want the old thing that's classic and has a history to it.
I think in the world of Scotch whisky, innovation is definitely happening, but we're so controlled by the Scotch whisky regulations that the innovation is kind of ring-fenced. So it means that whatever is ultimately created would never be so far removed from what we know to be Scotch whisky that is safe in that sense. You're not going to get something mad because it just wouldn't be allowed to be called Scotch whisky. It could be called spirit drink, you know, and there are some people going down this route of doing things that are pretty mad and having to deal with the consequence that they can call it whiskey.
Yeah.
They have to call it spirit drink, which is less sexy.
Bizarre. Spirit drink, that sounds quite floaty, doesn't it?
Yeah, it is odd. But I mean, the innovation, I still think there's enough room within the Scotch whisky regulations to be creative. And we are still seeing fascinating innovations, as we've already talked about, on, you know, varieties of barley and yeasts and, you know, all of these other elements. The wood, again, is another thing. Yes, we can only use oak in Scotland. That's pretty defined, but people have done other wood types, but just not been able to call it Scotch whisky.
And does the Scotch whisky industry thrive on the regulations and love the fact that it's contained, or are there people who go, oh, come on, we want to just allow us to do something new?
There's a kind of bit of both. There's parties on both sides of the fence. I mean, I think Scotch whisky wouldn't be where it is today if it wasn't for being so heavily controlled and regulated. I think it's protecting the place of quality that Scotch whisky has in the market. And I think if it wasn't that way, we would be like what gin is, which is an absolute mess and a wild west and bloody hundreds of gins that don't taste of juniper, which just drives me mad, which is, it's a flavoured vodka. Come on. So I'm grateful in a way that we do have this in Scotland. But the cool thing is we're seeing so many new single malt projects appearing around the world that they're looking to Scotland as inspiration to follow the kind of ideas of let's do 3 years of maturation minimum and so on and so on. But actually they can tweak a little bit further and say, actually, we're going to try and use this local wood that we've got because we don't have to use oak, you know, or we're going to use this slightly different way of doing something or local different grains, for example. So I think that's what's exciting. There is at that level, but there is still plenty of interesting R&D happening within Scotland. You know, there's a lot of industry collaborative R&D. There's a Scotch Whisky Research Institute that's owned by the industry that is just a building full of scientists trying to dig deeper into Scotch whisky every day. Yeah. So there is plenty of R&D happening.
Yeah. And there's a lot of money, presumably, in the industry to be able to play with all those things as well.
Yeah, but there's also a lot of experimentation in the fact that, you know, people are now doing rye whiskey, which would have been absolutely frowned upon in Scotland. You know, we're not meant to make rye whiskey, really. We're meant to make single grain whiskey, which is continuously distilled usually, and malted barley, which is single malt whiskey. But, you know, people have started to do rye. And historically, we probably would have made rye whiskey because, again, it was a grain that was grown in Scotland. So I think that's quite interesting and exciting. And that, for me, is where whiskey's heading now. Is like, we're going to have this new emerging category of single rye whiskey from Scotland that tastes completely different. If people haven't tried, you know, if people haven't tried an American style kind of bourbon or rye before, it's a very different, spicy, earthy, nutty, you know, it's not malted single malt whiskey, you know, it's different. And I think that's really exciting.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to hold you back from talking about the future because we still have one more to taste and I'm very much enjoying the experience.
Yeah, this kind of is the future and the past. So this is from Lindos Abbey that I touched on earlier. So remember 1494? So this family, basically, who owned the land, heard this, or they knew about this story, about this connection of 1494. And I visited them, you know, back in maybe 2013, 14, and saw this kind of abandoned steading. And they said, look, we really want to build a distillery here. And I was like, oh, you should definitely go for it. And everyone was saying, go for it. And now fast forward, they've got a three-year-old whiskey that's come out just in the last year. The distillery is this stunningly sensitive, architecturally beautiful building, bringing whiskey back to this place that played such a historically important part in our story of Scotch whisky. So have a smell and a taste of this.
So it's both ancient and modern at the same time. I love it.
Precisely.
It's got its story all cooked up already. Okay, so let's pour a little bit of Lindor's. Ooh.
So this is, again, you know, it's the other end of the country in Fife, so not far from Edinburgh, and it's got this lovely, soft, but sweet, kind of grassy, floral.
Yeah. Very floral, isn't it?
Almost like walking into a florist, you know?
Yeah.
It's like kind of the florist's just received delivery.
Yeah, sort of zesty, floral. That's extraordinary. Gosh, that is so different from the last two. That's amazing.
This is only 3 years old.
Yeah.
You know, and again, until recently, this new wave of distilleries, people weren't used to drinking three-year-old whiskey. They were used to drinking, you know, Highland Park 12 or Glenfiddich 12 or, you know, it was kind of 10 and 12 was the kind of start point. And these distilleries needed, because of cash flow, to get something out at 3 years old. So they were specifically...
Absolutely, yeah. Otherwise, you'd literally just run out of cash along the way.
Yeah, it's a massively, you know, huge capital expense to build a distillery. And you've got to lay down casks and you've got to lay down spirit all the time. So they were specifically designed in a way that their spirit would be ready at 3 years, you know, which is different to the other guys that know that they can leave it for 10, 12, 20, whatever.
Yeah.
So I think it's incredibly exciting, though, at this new stage of whisky, where three-year-old whisky is not shunned or seen to be inferior because of its age. Or, you know, there was this whole conversation around older equals better, which just isn't true. And I think, you know, this is a great example of that.
That's extraordinary, isn't it? And it sounds, it's just very exciting to reinvigorate an industry, to start again and to take that risk.
And it's popping up in places where, you know, it's bringing jobs to local communities. Another great example is the Isle of Rasay distillery. So Rasay is a tiny island right next to Skye. So you go onto the island of Skye and then you've got to get a short ferry to kind of hop across to Rasay. And they've just released their inaugural kind of three-year, well, they've now got kind of other ranges as well. But it's something like only 100 people live on this island, and now more than half of them all work at the distillery. You know, and it's brought back this, and it's also brought back a younger generation that essentially had to leave the island because there wasn't something for them there. So they've kind of gone to the mainland, done a couple of years in London or wherever, and now have this amazing global career opportunity to go back home. And it's amazing.
And that's extraordinary, isn't it? And that happens, I see that a lot in France. So I spend quite a lot of time in France, and you see small villages that used to be full of young families and people go out into the fields and you know, you'd have a few patches of vines, in, often scattered around. And they just can't keep young people in villages anymore. And they're trying all sorts of different things that aren't really working that well. So to be able to do that and to bring decent jobs somewhere is, I mean, that is extraordinary, isn't it?
And then it means that the people working there are the most genuine, authentic ambassadors, because they were like, oh, I used to run around in this field when I was a kid, and that's my granddad's house over there. And,
yeah.
You know, like, that's, it's just lovely. You know, it's so genuine and authentic. And it's so exciting to see these businesses become successful brands in their own right.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, so this Lindor's is now, it's sort of, there are phases that you go through. You start, as you say, you start tasting and you get one thing, and then it kind of calms down and you start experiencing different things from what goes up your nose and what's on your palate. And I'm beginning to get more kind of slightly sort of vanilla-y, back to the sort of toffee vanilla.
Yeah, there's a bit of kind of peanut butter brittle kind of, yeah. And actually, we've got chocolate for you to try. So have a little nibble of chocolate with this one.
Okay, so.
And see how that brings out. And I want you to try it where you can have a bit of chocolate first and then a sip of whiskey and then see what that does.
And we're going for the Lindor's, are we?
Yeah, with the Lindor's, yeah.
With the Lindor's, yeah. Okay, so Blair very kindly sent me a little block of Isle of Skye sea salt dark chocolate from Coco. Here we go. Yeah,
it's an excellent little Edinburgh chocolatier that just make very high quality chocolates. So it's got salt in it to kind of make the flavours pop.
Oh, okay. So I mean, these are two of the most notoriously densely flavoured things on the planet. So let's see. I might actually explode here. Let's see what happens. Okay, the creaminess of the chocolate, extraordinary depth.
And see how it changes compared to what you've just had neat.
A little bit more. Getting the spiciness, the kind of richness of the chocolate experience. Okay, here we go with the Lindor's as well. Oh, you're tasting completely different compounds there, all of a sudden. Yeah. You're right, it's a whole different. I have never thought of that before, the idea of chocolate and whiskey.
It's a great pairing. I mean, chocolate and whiskey and cheese, whiskey and ice cream. I'm a huge fan of whiskey affogatos. I think whiskey you can have a lot of fun with whiskey.
Yeah.
So now try the other one. Try and sip. Try and hold the whiskey within your mouth without dribbling, and see if you can put in a bit of chocolate, and try and let the try and let it kind of mingle, and see if you can, see if you can have it mingling together, the melting of the chocolate hitting your palate with the whiskey.
Oh my gosh, it's like being hit on the face with sensory information. Mm. Wow, and
maybe
the creaminess
too much
versus the heat. Friday lunchtime. The spiciness with the heat, the creaminess of the chocolate, the melting of the cocoa butter. It's like a festival going off in your mouth, isn't it?
Yeah. Absolutely. And it's not difficult to, you know, to pair whiskey with food. A lot of people think you can only pair, you know, wine with meals. And I used to do a lot of paired dinners where, you know, I've worked with Michelin star chefs where we've done a 12 course tasting menu with whiskeys with each course, you know, just little tastes. But again, it can change the whole experience, you know, doing things where we've put whiskey in little miniature kind of spritz bottles, you know, spritzing the food before eating it. Or actually, if you vaporize and spritz it onto your palate, you get, again, it's more oxidized. It's a bit like kind of slurping. It's that same thing. You can just have fun with whiskey. People get too obsessed about protecting it. And I think there's a time and a place to be, you know, special about whiskey, definitely, and protect its heritage and everything, but actually you can still have a lot of fun with it, because it's, at the end of the day, it's just a drink, you know?
Absolutely, and entertainment as well as well, I mean,
enjoyment,
a tiny bit of nutrition, but not a lot. Okay, now let's get back to the nuts and bolts of this, and let's talk about the state of the whiskey industry today. Is it healthy? I mean, we've gone through a couple of very turbulent years. How's it faring with all of that, and what's happening in this world?
It's incredibly healthy, incredibly buoyant. You know, there was a very, I would say, short blip where suddenly we started making, you know, thousands of litres of hand gel because that's what we thought we had to do.
Yep.
And then very quickly shifted back to more whiskey production. So it wasn't like other industries where, you know, there might not be a 2020 or 2021 vintage or whatever, you know, definitely not the case in whiskey. It's performed very well. And, you know, as we've already said, it's a long-term game. So the whiskey being bottled now was laid down kind of pre-pandemic. It was all kind of part of that journey. So this will be one of these blips that whiskey will kind of ride out. You know, the appetite and demand is still growing massively. You know, my business has just grown on this kind of like hockey stick of demand from people who want top end, very hard and rare casks of whiskey, because everybody seems to want them at the moment, which is nice. You know, people who have a bit more disposable income want something that others can't maybe access easily. But generally, even at the kind of on-trade level, places are reopening, businesses are doing well again. people were maybe a bit more experimental during lockdown, and actually people were, they thought, generally people thought that there'd be less drinking, but actually home drinking became quite common and people had a bit more money to spend on interesting things and, you know, direct deliveries of cocktails and online shopping. So I would say that it is in a very strong position. We've already seen that in the results from last quarter.
Yeah. When a distillery produces a batch, does it always pretty much get sold, or do companies struggle to shift their stuff? Is it just about pricing?
It's, I mean, when there's limited editions, it's cutthroat. I mean, just last week, there was a shocking incident in London where police were called to a shop. So queues had formed for this limited edition. What makes it so disappointing is that it was a charity release to raise money for Ukraine. So it was a special release of a Springbank whiskey. Fights broke out and someone was arrested. And this is becoming common, which is shocking and disappointing that people are so fixated on having this. And unfortunately, it's being driven by people flipping bottles. So bottles are selling out instantly and then people are flipping them within days on the internet for double, triple, quadruple what they were originally bought for. And again, this is inflating and, you know, increasing the heat in this space, unfortunately. So it's a kind of double-edged sword, unfortunately.
Yeah. And what about the sort of the craft industry side of this? Would you call the Lindor's a craft whiskey?
I mean, craft is a very vague word, unfortunately, in the drink space now. They're a much smaller scale. I mean, I think artisanal or, you know, something else might be a better way to describe them. You know, more hands-on, less about yield. A lot of the big distilleries are all about increasing yield, you know, with lower costs because the shareholders want that. Whereas a lot of these are still independently owned and they can push flavour and experiments and, you know, their customers will tell them, oh, we love that, make more of that, please. So I think there's definitely an exciting wave of craft, you know, not just in Scotland.
Yeah.
You know, there is this kind of micro-sized distillery, much smaller business that they'll never be able to compete. And that's not their business plan. You know, they can only fill 6 casks a week kind of thing. You know, they're never going to compete with the big boys.
Yeah.
And they're not trying to. They want to do something that's high quality and they can charge a premium for that. And again, it makes it scarce, it makes it limited, but then you get that problem where people want it so much that they keep missing out, that it inflates the secondary market price and so on. So there is a bit of a balancing out that will need to be done at some point.
Yeah. And I mentioned about distilleries popping up around the world. So we've got Tasmania, India. I mean, gosh, I've drunk some Indian whiskey. Woo!
There's some fantastic... India is the biggest producer of whiskey in the world, but it's not what you and I would call whiskeys. A lot of it's made from molasses.
Yeah.
So strictly speaking, it's rum. But there are a few examples of fantastic single malt made in India. And they have a fascinating issue with angel share because of the heat. They have kind of 16 to 20% angel share, which is the evaporation in the cask, per annum. In Scotland, we have 1 or 2, you know, and it's fascinating.
Angel share is such a beautiful term, isn't it? I love it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what would you say? I mean, certainly places like Japan have been very successful with some of their whiskies. What's the nature of the industry? Are they producing something very different? Do they have different things that they are marketing their products on? How does the industry shift and change around the world?
So it's kind of a little bit looking at like new world wine and old world wine in that sense. You know, these are newer entrants, but actually a lot of them are now a couple decades in, you know, several decades in the example of Japan. And I think what's really exciting is they're all making whiskey that we understand to be malt whiskey, but they're doing it in their own way with their own environment. And it's environmental elements that I think are most fascinating and exciting. So, you know, Japan has its own climate. India has its own climate. The fascinating one is this most northerly distillery in the world, the Bifrost Aurora Spirits Distillery. I've been fortunate enough to visit them twice. You know, it's in the Arctic Circle. It's so cold that they're having to store some of their casks underground, subterranean.
Oh, crikey, yeah.
Kind of, it's actually in a former NATO base. So they've got all these abandoned tunnels that they're using to store their casks. And again, they're having an interesting influence there because they were worried when they started, would they get enough of that expansion and contraction in the seasons that you need really for the wood to mature the whiskey?
Okay.
You need a bit of that kind of conversation in the seasons with the wood and the spirit.
Yeah.
And actually they've managed to have that balance, and changes in air pressure will provide that as well. So I think that's what's most fascinating is we're seeing these people make very high quality whiskey in their own localized way. And I think that's really exciting.
But is there a little part of you that's a little bit of Blair that says, I really don't want you to succeed. I want Scotch whiskey to be the big thing.
Absolutely not. The complete opposite of that. No, I mean, I think Scotch whisky will always be the top of the pyramid, as I said at the start of our chat. Just because of all the reasons we've discussed about, you know, we've got the heritage, we've got the history, we've got the quality. And I think even if somebody is a new whisky drinker and they try their local whisky first, be it Japanese or Tasmanian or bourbon or whatever, they're going to try their domestic whisky first because it's going to be cheaper because it's not been imported. But eventually they will always aspire to drink a Scotch whisky because Scotch whisky is Scotch whisky. You know, and that's, you know, at the moment there's these big ongoing talks in India because at the moment there's a 150% import tariff in India. Yeah. And there's a billion people that want Scotch whisky, but at the moment can't justify buying it. So buying locally made whisky because there's this aspirational drive to drink high quality products. And there is this new emerging wealth in lots of pockets around the world. So sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, Asia, where, you know, they want all the things that come with an affluent lifestyle. And amazingly, Scotch whisky is perceived as that luxury product because of its craft and skill and quality and heritage. And it's part of that kind of piece. And it is this aspirational product that people want to enjoy and consume. And it has everything that we've talked about. You know, it's liquid history.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, let's talk a little bit about you and your work. You founded World Whisky Day back in 2012, is that right?
Yes, that was the first one. Yeah, I was 21 at the time.
That's extraordinary age to do something that spectacular. So tell us about World Whisky Day and what led you to start it.
So I was studying languages and I was living in Spain at the time as part of my degree. And I saw one day it was World Gin Day. And before that, I'd actually set up a whisky club at Aberdeen University in my freshers week with two others. So I was kind of deep into whisky already and saw it was World Gin Day. You know, I was quite into gin and gin cocktails and was quite fascinated that there was this idea of a World Gin Day, and they had worldginday.com. And it had a nice Google map with pins of events happening all around the world. So I just typed in worldwhiskyday.com and it was available. So I bought it and got a friend who made websites to basically do the same thing. And it just took off. Yeah. You know, it just was in the early phases. It was still, you know, 2012, you know, the internet was still, social media was still new-ish. So there wasn't the algorithms that we have now. So things could go viral very, very quickly without having to spend any money. So it was completely organic, you know, and it just grew. And within 48 hours, people all around the world were messaging me saying, you know, I've told every bar in Sydney, put us on the map, what can we do? And it was really, for me, the whole, a lot of people were quite critical at the start to say, well, you know, every day's World Whisky Day. And I was like, well, maybe for you, but actually a lot of people never touch whisky. And yeah. I'm really passionate about getting people excited about whisky. And I thought this is a perfect vehicle for that. In the same way that, you know, some people never have Guinness and then it's St. Patrick's Day and they think, oh, it's St. Patrick's Day, I'm going to have a Guinness. I've not had a Guinness in ages. Sometimes people just need that little nudge or that little prompt to try something new. And that was the way that I positioned it to the industry and said, look, if we're all shouting about whisky, be it Japanese or Irish or Scotch or American or Indian or whatever, if we're all shouting about whisky on this one day collectively, collaboratively, then it's going to be beneficial for everybody. And yeah, last year, amazingly, it was the 10th, you know, World Whisky Day. I still can't really believe it. And I see every year, you know, thousands of events all around the world. We even had events in Antarctica one year, four events in Antarctica. So it is surreal to see all these people just celebrating whisky in all shapes and forms and in cocktails and no snobbery, and everybody's welcome to try whisky that day.
That's fantastic. Now, you must have tasted loads of different whiskies. I mean, I know, clearly you have. Anything that surprised you? Anything that's blown you away for any particular reason? Is it and why is that? Is that the story? Is it the taste? Or is it a combination of everything that's thrown at you? What's the most interesting whisky you've tried?
That's a fantastic question. Do you mean a good thing or a bad, or good reasons or bad reasons or both?
I think either. I mean, I'm interested in what made you think again and go, oh, hang on, I thought I knew everything about this, but this changes everything.
Yeah, I think that's a nice way to put it. I mean, I think whisky's pretty special in terms of connections and people. And for me, it's not always just about what's in the glass. It was about sometimes about the place or the people I was with and that kind of shared experience, that kind of convivial feeling that you get from, you know, wine as food or, you know, restaurant experiences. You might not remember all the courses that you had at that restaurant, but you remember the kind of the shared feeling. So I did host an event in Speyside that was a nighttime walk a couple of years ago, where I gave everyone a Glencairn glass and a head torch, and we drank whisky by the River Spey, and we'd hidden all these kind of surprises along the route, including, you know, throwing a jug into the River Spey to add water from the Spey in the whisky. We'd buried whisky on a little beach that was hidden at the end of the kind of the walk.
Very good.
To say, you know, here's some marshmallows. You can, they're infused with whiskey, but, you know, we don't have any more whiskey to get. Oh, there's something under your fruit, sir. Oh, there's a whole bottle of whiskey there. So, you know, things like that for me are really memorable. But in terms of specifically your question, the most incredible whiskey that I got to try recently, I was very fortunate to try, was an 80-year-old whiskey. At the time, it was the oldest whiskey ever bottled from Gordon MacPhail. It was an 80-year-old Glenlivet. And it's just mind-boggling, really, to drink a whiskey like that. So I got sent a very small sample, and I had a client that was buying it, and I was able to kind of talk them through it on a Zoom call. And I actually spent before that whole day with this whiskey on my desk. I didn't do anything that day. This might sound really sad. But I just poured it in a glass and just sat there and just kept coming back to it, and probably smelt it for over several hours before I took my first sip of it. Yeah. Just because I didn't want to lose that moment, because there was 80 years build up to that moment.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I was worried. I've been very lucky to taste a lot of old, you know, 50 plus year old whiskies in my work. And unfortunately, sometimes they do hit a point where they've been in wood too long. They don't taste like whiskey. They taste like liquid wood. You know, and I was worried, you know, especially this is so old, but no, it had everything. It had all that charm and magic and everything. It was just, it came in waves as well. You know, it was really hard to describe the fact that it, you know, something seems to happen when whiskey gets to a certain point. If it's still got a high alcohol strength, which again is unusual, but the way it's, you know, stored can help that. But if it's still got this high alcohol strength, the alcohol molecules seem to mature themselves as well. So then you get this different viscosity. It's hard to articulate, but it's quite overwhelming. You know, it just comes in this wave of flavor and textural experience. And for me, that was a real standout of the last few years.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so the last question, I need you to be very partisan now. You're stranded on a desert island. You can only have one whiskey for company. Would it be that 80-year-old Glenlivet, or would you choose something else for a different reason?
I think I would choose a Johnnie Walker Black Label.
Mm-hmm. And why is that?
For me, it's just a fantastic whiskey. And in my days pre-pandemic, traveling a lot, every bar that I went to would have a Johnnie Walker Black.
Yeah.
You know, I'd be on the other side of the world, a new country, new climate, new whatever. And that was consistently amazing wherever you go, because it's Johnnie Walker Black.
And is it like a taste of home?
Yeah, it's that kind of, you know.
Or a taste of a centre, something that brings you back to something that you know.
Comfort. It's that kind of familiar feeling. You know, and knowing that I could drink it, I love it as a highball. So with, you know, soda water, which again, every bar will have, or ginger ale or whatever the local mixer might be, if it's a hot country or if it's a, you know, colder climate, just, you know, neat or maybe on the rocks. And it's just that consistent quality that, you know, in a lot of my work, I'm doing single cask, single malt whiskey. So when I'm not working, I'll probably actually have a Johnnie Walker Black, because for me, it's that kind of like familiar comfort. Yeah, it's just, it is what it is. And I like its versatility and consistency. So if I was stuck on a desert island, I would take that with me.
Yeah, beautifully put. Okay. Well, Blair Bowman, thank you so much for joining me. It's been so informative, and your passion obviously shines through like crazy. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are plenty more at foodmatterslive.com. I won't be looking at them now. I need a bit of a lie down. But for example, if you go to the site and search the history of gin, you'll get the episode where we look into the past of the drink that gave birth to the phrase Dutch courage. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And thank you so much for listening.